Section 11 of Supernatural Horror in Literature by Howard Phillips Lovecraft. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Read by Piotr Natter. The Modern Masters, Part 2. Unexcelled in the sorcery of crystalline singing prose, and supreme in the creation of a gorgeous and languorous world of iridescently exotic vision, is Edward John Morton Drax Plunkett, 18th Baron Dunsany, whose tales and short plays form an almost unique element in our literature. Inventor of a new mythology and weaver of surprising folklore, Lord Dunsany stands dedicated to a strange world of fantastic beauty and pledged to eternal warfare against the coarseness and ugliness of diurnal reality. His point of view is the most truly cosmic of any held in the literature of any period. As sensitive as Poe to dramatic values and the significance of isolated words and details, and far better equipped rhetorically through a simple lyric style based on the prose of the King James Bible, this author draws with tremendous effectiveness on nearly every body of myth and legend within the circle of European culture, producing a composite or eclectic cycle of fantasy in which Eastern color, Hellenic form, Teutonic somberness, and Celtic wistfulness are so superbly blended that each sustains and supplements the rest without sacrifice of perfect congruity and homogeneity. In most cases, Dunsany's lands are fabulous, beyond the East or at the edge of the world. His system of original personal and place names, with roots drawn from classical, oriental, and other sources, is a marvel of versatile inventiveness and poetic discrimination, as one may see from such specimens as Argimenes, Betmora, Portanes, Camorak, Iluriel, or Sardatrion. Beauty rather than terror is the keynote of Dunsany's work. He loves the vivid green of jade and of copper domes, and the delicate flush of sunset on the ivory minarets of impossible dream cities. Humor and irony, too, are often present to impart a gentle cynicism and modify what might otherwise possess a naive intensity. Nevertheless, as is inevitable in a master of triumphant unreality, there are occasional touches of cosmic fright which come well within the authentic tradition. Dunsany loves to hint slyly and adroitly of monstrous things and incredible dooms, as one hints in a fairy tale. In The Book of Wonder, we read of Hlo-Hlo, the gigantic spider idol which does not always stay at home, of what the Sphinx feared in the forest, of Slith, the thief who jumps over the edge of the world after seeing a certain light lit and knowing who lit it, of the Anthropophagus gibbelins, who inhabit an evil tower and guard a treasure, of the gnolls, who live in the forest and from whom it is not well to steal, of the city of Never and the eyes that watch in the underpits, and of the kindred things of darkness. A Dreamer's Tales tells of the mystery that sent forth old men from Bethmora in the desert, of the vast gate of Perdondaris that was carved from a single piece of ivory, and of the voyage of poor old Bill, whose captain cursed the crew and paid calls on nasty-looking isles new risen from the sea, with low thatched cottages having evil obscure windows. Many of Dunsany's short plays are replete with spectral fear. In The Gods of the Mountain, seven beggars impersonate the seven green idols on a distant hill, and enjoy ease and honor in a city of worshippers, until they hear that the real idols are missing from their wonted seats. A very ungainly sight in the dusk is reported to them. Rock should not walk in the evening. And at last, as they sit awaiting the arrival of a troop of dancers, they note that the approaching footsteps are heavier than those of good dancers ought to be. Then things ensue, and in the end the presumptuous blasphemers are turned to green jade statues by the very walking statues whose sanctity they outraged. But mere plot is the very least merit of this marvelously effective play. The incidents and developments are those of a supreme master, so that the whole forms one of the most important contributions of the present age, not only to drama, but to literature in general. A Night at an Inn tells of four thieves who have stolen the Emerald Eye of Clash, a monstrous Hindu god. They lure to their room and succeed in slaying the three priestly avengers who are on their track. But in the night, Mesh comes gropingly for his eye, and having gained it and departed, calls each of the despoilers out into the darkness for an unnamed punishment. In The Laughter of the Gods, there is a doomed city at the jungle's edge, and a ghostly lutenist, heard only by those about to die. Confer Alice's spectral harpsichord in Hawthorne's House of the Seven Gables, whilst The Queen's Enemies retells the anecdote of Herodotus, in which a vengeful princess invites her foes to a subterranean banquet and lets in the Nile to drown them. But no amount of mere description can convey more than a fraction of Lord Dunsany's pervasive charm. His prismatic cities and unheard-of rites are touched with a sureness which only mastery can engender, and we thrill with a sense of actual participation in his secret mysteries. To the truly imaginative, he is a talisman and a key unlocking rich storehouses of dream and fragmentary memory, so that we may think of him not only as a poet, but as one who makes each reader a poet as well. At the opposite pole of genius from Lord Dunsany, and gifted with an almost diabolic power of calling horror by gentle steps from the midst of prosaic daily life, is the scholarly Montagu Rhodes James, provost of Eton College, antiquary of note, and recognized authority on medieval manuscripts and cathedral history. Dr. James, long fond of telling spectral tales at Christmastide, has become by slow degrees a literary weird fictionist of the very first rank, and has developed a distinctive style and method likely to serve as models for an enduring line of disciples. The art of Dr. James is by no means haphazard, and in the preface to one of his collections he has formulated three very sound rules for macabre composition. A ghost story, he believes, should have a familiar setting in the modern period, in order to approach closely the reader's sphere of experience. Its spectral phenomena, moreover, should be malevolent rather than beneficent, since fear is the emotion primarily to be excited. And finally, the technical patois of occultism or pseudoscience ought carefully to be avoided, lest the charm of casual verisimilitude be smothered in unconvincing pedantry. Dr. James, practicing what he preaches, approaches his themes in a light and often conversational way. Creating the illusion of everyday events, he introduces his abnormal phenomena cautiously and gradually, relieved at every turn by touches of homely and prosaic detail, and sometimes spiced with a snatch or two of antiquarian scholarship. Conscious of the dose relation between present weirdness and accumulated tradition, he generally provides remote historical antecedents for his incidents, thus being able to utilize very aptly his exhaustive knowledge of the past, and his ready and convincing command of archaic diction and coloring. A favorite scene for a James tale is some centuried cathedral, which the author can describe with all the familiar minuteness of a specialist in that field. Sly humorous vignettes and bits of lifelike genre portraiture and characterization are often to be found in Dr. James's narratives, and serve in his skilled hands to augment the general effect rather than to spoil it, as the same qualities would tend to do with a lesser craftsman. In inventing a new type of ghost, he has departed considerably from the conventional Gothic tradition, for where the older stock ghosts were pale and stately, and apprehended chiefly through the sense of sight, the average James ghost is lean, dwarfish, and hairy, a sluggish, hellish night abomination, midway betwixt beast and man, and usually touched before it is seen. Sometimes the spectre is of still more eccentric composition, a roll of flannel with spidery eyes, or an invisible entity which moulds itself in bedding and shows a face of crumpled linen. Dr. James has, it is clear, an intelligent and scientific knowledge of human nerves and feelings, and knows just how to apportion statement, imagery, and subtle suggestions in order to secure the best results with his readers. He is an artist in incident and arrangement rather than in atmosphere, and reaches the emotions more often through the intellect than directly. This method, of course, with its occasional absences of sharp climax, has its drawbacks as well as its advantages, and many will miss the thorough atmospheric tension which writers like Machen are careful to build up with words and scenes. but only a few of the tales are open to the charge of tameness. Generally, the laconic unfolding of abnormal events in adroit order is amply sufficient to produce the desired effect of cumulative horror. The short stories of Dr. James are contained in four small collections, entitled respectively Ghost Stories of an Antiquary, More Ghost Stories of an Antiquary, A Thin Ghost and Others, and A Warning to the Curious. There is also a delightful juvenile fantasy, The Five Jars, which has its spectral adumbrations. Amidst this wealth of material, it is hard to select a favorite or specially typical tale, though each reader will no doubt have such preferences as his temperament may determine. Count Magnus is assuredly one of the best, forming, as it does, a veritable Golconda of suspense and suggestion. Mr. Wraxhall is an English traveller of the middle 19th century, sojourning in Sweden to secure material for a book. Becoming interested in the ancient family of De la Gardie, near the village of Rabac, he studies its records and finds particular fascination in the builder of the existing manor house, one Count Magnus, of whom strange and terrible things are whispered. The Count, who flourished early in the 17th century, was a stern landlord and famous for his severity toward poachers and delinquent tenants. His cruel punishments were bywords, and there were dark rumors of influences which even survived his interment in the great mausoleum he built near the church, as the case of the two peasants who hunted on his preserves one night a century after his death. There were hideous screams in the woods, and near the tomb of Count Magnus, an unnatural laugh and the clang of a great door. Next morning the priest found the two men, one a maniac and the other dead, with the flesh of his face sucked from the bones. Mr. Wraxhall hears all these tales and stumbles on more guarded references to a black pilgrimage once taken by the Count, a pilgrimage to Chorazin in Palestine, one of the cities denounced by our Lord in the Scriptures, and in which old priests say that Antichrist is to be born. No one dares to hint just what the black pilgrimage was, or what strange being or thing the Count brought back as a companion. Meanwhile, Mr. Wraxhall is increasingly anxious to explore the mausoleum of Count Magnus, and finally secures permission to do so, in the company of a deacon. He finds several monuments and three copper sarcophagi, one of which is the Count's. Round the edge of this latter are several bands of engraved scenes, including a singular and hideous delineation of a pursuit. The pursuit of a frantic man through a forest by a squat, muffled figure with a devil-fish's tentacle, directed by a tall, cloaked man on a neighboring hillock. The sarcophagus has three massive steel padlocks, one of which is lying open on the floor, reminding the traveler of a metallic clash he heard the day before, when passing the mausoleum and wishing idly that he might see Count Magnus. His fascination augmented, and the key being accessible, Mr. Wraxhall pays the mausoleum a second and solitary visit, and finds another padlock unfastened. The next day, his last in Rabac, he again goes alone to bid the long-dead Count farewell, once more queerly impelled to utter a whimsical wish for a meeting with the buried nobleman. He now sees, to his disquiet, that only one of the padlocks remains on the great sarcophagus. Even as he looks, that last lock drops noisily to the floor, and there comes a sound as of creaking hinges. Then the monstrous lid appears very slowly to rise, and Mr. Wraxhall flees in panic fear without refastening the door of the mausoleum. During his return to England, the traveller feels a curious uneasiness about his fellow passengers on the canal boat, which he employs for the earlier stages. Cloaked figures make him nervous, and he has a sense of being watched and followed. Of 28 persons whom he counts, only 26 appear at meals, and the missing two are always a tall, cloaked man and a shorter, muffled figure. Completing his water travel at Harwich, Mr. Wraxhall takes frankly to fright in a closed carriage, but sees two cloaked figures at a crossroad. Finally, he lodges at a small house in a village and spends the time making frantic notes. On the second morning, he is found dead, and during the inquest, seven jurors faint at sight of the body. The house where he stayed is never again inhabited, and upon its demolition half a century later, his manuscript is discovered in a forgotten cupboard. In The Treasure of Abbot Thomas, a British antiquary unriddles a cipher on some Renaissance-painted windows, and thereby discovers a centuried hoard of gold in a niche halfway down a well in the courtyard of a German abbey. But the crafty depositor had set a guardian over that treasure, and something in the black well twines its arms around the searcher's neck in such a manner that the quest is abandoned and the clergyman sent for. Each night after that, the discoverer feels a stealthy presence and detects a horrible odor of mold outside the door of his hotel room, till finally the clergyman makes a daylight replacement of the stone at the mouth of the treasure vault in the well, out of which something had come in the dark to avenge the disturbing of old Abbot Thomas's gold. As he completes his work, the cleric observes a curious toad-like carving on the ancient well-head, with the Latin motto, Depositum custodi, keep that which is committed to thee. Other notable James tales are The Stalls of Barchester Cathedral, in which a grotesque carving comes curiously to life to avenge the secret and subtle murder of an old dean by his ambitious successor, O Whistle and I'll Come to Thee, which tells of the horror summoned by a strange metal whistle found in a medieval church ruin, and An Episode of Cathedral History, where the dismantling of a pulpit uncovers an archaic tomb whose lurking demons spreads panic and pestilence. Dr. James, for all his light touch, evokes fright and hideousness in their most shocking form, and will certainly stand as one of the few really creative masters in his darksome province. For those who relish speculation regarding the future, the tale of supernatural horror provides an interesting field. Combated by a mounting wave of plodding realism, cynical flippancy, and sophisticated disillusionment, it is yet encouraged by a parallel tide of growing mysticism, as developed both through the fatigued reaction of occultists and religious fundamentalists against materialistic discovery, and through the stimulation of wonder and fancy by such enlarged vistas and broken barriers as modern science has given us, with its intra-atomic chemistry, advancing astrophysics, doctrines of relativity, and probings into biology and human thought. At the present moment, the favoring forces would appear to have somewhat of an advantage, since there is unquestionably more cordiality shown toward weird writings than when, 30 years ago, the best of Arthur Machen's work fell on the stony ground of the smart and cocksure 90s. Ambrose Bierce, almost unknown in his own time, has now reached something like general recognition. Startling mutations, however, are not to be looked for in either direction. In any case, an approximate balance of tendencies will continue to exist, and while we may justly expect a further subtilization of technique, we have no reason to think that the general position of the spectral in literature will be altered. It is a narrow, though essential, branch of human expression, and will chiefly appeal, as always, to a limited audience with keen special sensibilities. Whatever universal masterpiece of tomorrow may be wrought from phantasm or terror, will owe its acceptance rather to a supreme workmanship than to a sympathetic theme. Yet who shall declare the dark theme a positive handicap? Radiant with beauty, the cup of the Ptolemies was carved of onyx. End of section 11. End of Supernatural Horror in Literature by Howard Phillips Lovecraft. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit legamus.eu.